There's a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pits of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination in an area which we call Elder Dragon Journey.
Hello again, this is your host Igor, with me, as always, my partner in crime, Niksha.
Say hi, Niksha. No, wait.
Say. What?
Okay, yeah, Niksha.
And for this episode, we actually have a really special guest, a person I've been listening to for many, many years now. With us, the one and only Kevin Krohn.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. We've been having more pre-show talk with you than with any other guest we ever had.
Nice.
So that's Mark. Nice. Kevin, who the hell are you? Introduce yourself to our listeners.
My name's Kevin Krohn. I am a longtime Magic player. Started playing in 1994.
Jeez.
The set was Legends. Although I didn't buy those Legends booster packs when they were on the shelf, after they came out. Because there is no way that I was going to spend $10 on a booster pack, right? Same goes for those $15 Arabian Nights boosters pack when I could spend like $2.50 on a revised. So I was very economical and wise in my youth.
Mm-hmm. Look what's happening to you.
I played casually for a number of years up till college. In college, I started playing a little bit. Well, we still played very casually, but also started playing a little bit more competitively, did a little bit of PTQing when I was in my youth. That was back in the old extended format, which doesn't exist anymore. Shortly after college, I moved to a new town, met some new friends, still played casually, but it was around 2001 or 2 that I met my now longtime friend, Steve Menendian, who introduced me to Vintage. Steve and I started playing Vintage in the Central Ohio area for many years. A couple years later, we started a podcast, which is how you all know me and how many people would. We are now the hosts of the So Many Insane Plays podcast, which is a Vintage-focused podcast and has been going for several years now, even though we have only a few more episodes than the two of you because we record so infrequently.
Yeah, you're recording schedule.
But along that path, yeah, once every month or two.
Oh, yeah.
And along that path, I started playing EDH. And that EDH is now the format that I play probably the greatest volume of, because that's what local players play. Vintage is still my passion and the only competitive format that I truly follow and play, but I do play more EDH than anything else.
So what level of EDH do you play? Is it competitive, casual, something in the middle?
It's somewhere in the middle, thanks to the range of players in my local play group. They skew toward the younger, more budget-conscious people that start with the Commander precons and modify them, that kind of player. But unfortunately, my collection and my playstyle and everything about my commitment to Magic is much older and a little bit more competitive personally. So my decks are a little bit overmatched versus most of my local playgroup, and I have been, over the past couple of years since I moved to my current location in Grand Rapids, Michigan, I've been endeavoring to make decks that are a little more fair, a little less powerful, or at least fight on more fair axes.
So what kind of decks do you usually play? What archetype are those?
Lately, my favorite kind of deck is what I would call aggro with a little touch of combo kind of feel to it. That is an aggro deck that kills you with creature damage, but continues to build up resources through either mana or card draw or some kind of iterative kind of resource growth. So examples of this, I think the best examples of this are Zagana, which mm-hmm. you probably know Zagana very well. I imagine your audience does. She just continues to pile on advantages by drawing cards. That's nothing new, right? But yeah, I'm killing with creatures. There's no combo kill. It's just I'm going to draw a ton of cards, make giant monsters, turn them all sideways. The next best example, which I think is a little bit more combo oriented, is Mazurek. Mazurek really surprised me when I built Mazurek, because I didn't give that general any any credence when he was printed. I looked at him and thought, oh, that's cute. That's five mana. It's going to trigger sometimes. Okay, fine. Next. Years later, I saw a primer for Mazurek that was very detail-oriented, very thorough, written and published on MTG Salvation. I was linked to that primer by my good friend Kirsten. He said, you should take a look at this. This looks like it's up your alley. Sure enough, there was a lot more play to Mazurek than I thought. Now my Mazurek deck is hated and feared by all, because it turns out that you can just build an efficient EDH deck with cheap creatures that has about 70 cards in it with the word sacrifice in them, and your army is enormous no matter what you start with. I can just play Land of War Elves on turn one, and my deck is incredibly explosive.
Yeah, Krekaland, my dudes are bigger. Sacrifice Eldrazi Scion, my dudes are bigger.
Precisely. You've got it exactly. And so Mazurek turned out to actually be stronger than I thought it was going to be by many orders of magnitude. Other examples of the kind of deck I'm talking about are I've got a partner deck, Timna plus Thrasios, which is just beatdown, just really quality beatdown, small creatures that continue to grow through certain effects. And then my latest and most enjoyable creation is Grimlock. Grimlock Dinobot Leader, which you can't, I just recently discovered, isn't even in Gatherer, which is strange.
It's because it's a Hascon promo only.
Right. Well, Grimlock has turned out to be a ton of fun. I had never built a Naya deck before. I had never built Mael or anything like it. And now this Grimlock deck is hilarious and much fun to play. So all my decks that I play most commonly now are just creature-based beatdown decks with an emphasis on some kind of resource gain, card draw or counters or something like that, mana.
Oh boy, I just going the really different direction than you go. Just looking at your philosophy and all that.
So your Grimlock, what's the creature type here for him? Or do you use him for the transform ability?
So it is ostensibly a tribal-style deck. One of the things that's attractive to Grimlock, for those of you who aren't familiar, Grimlock's a promo from Hascon, 4-4 for 4. He says, dinosaurs, vehicles, and other transformers, creatures you control, get +2/+0. He also transforms into an 8-8 trampler, but the backside's boring. It's just an 8-8 trampler. The front side is a lord for three different, creature types, to overuse an inappropriate term, dinosaurs, vehicles, and transformers. I was interested in this deck when Grimlock was spoiled, because we all knew Ixalan was coming up and there was going to be dinosaurs, so that's kind of cool. Kaladesh was fresh on everyone's mind, vehicles are cool, so I was in. Then Maro posted on his blog that any creature that uses the transform keyword counts as a transformer. At which point I was completely sold. So the deck is basically trying to be all three of those tribes, quote unquote, but it also has just a mix of really good stuff in it from Naya. I mean, this is the first deck I've ever had, and this is sounds like a newbie thing. This is the first deck I've ever had that casts Aurelia the War Leader, and that's a pretty filthy feeling when you've got enormous vehicles and stuff. So it's all those tribes. It's spread pretty thin. The vehicles are mostly awful. There's no good vehicles. Like Thopter, the copter, is a decent rate, but everyone else, they're all 4 and 5 mana for a couple of extra power. They're not a good value until you get Grimlock down, and then they're adding 4 to 6 power, and then they can become a little more potent. But the vehicles are definitely weak. There's not that many good dinosaurs. It's really, you know, the deck is more fun than good, but it can get really fun.
So is the Mirror Entity your MVP in the deck, or?
Mirror Entity is quite good. You're not wrong. That yeah, is a way to turn Aurelia into a dinosaur. Yes, I'll take two.
Yep. All right. So, as usual, we're going to do the Commander of the Week now. Kevin, you got some cool Commander stories you want to tell about your latest Commander exploits?
Well, I played two games last night. One with Grimlock, which was just a colossal beating. And I'll tell you why. It was because I played an Artifact Accelerant on 2 and 3. I played a Signet into a Thran Dynamo into Mana Reflection. And what that meant was by turn 5, I think I had Grimlock plus Aurelia plus a Thornling and a Stoneforge Mystic carrying a Sword of Fire and Ice. And I was swinging for like 30 a turn.
What the hell, man? What the hell?
It's just Naya, right? That's And I told my opponents right at the beginning, one of my opponents sat down with Rhys the Redeemed and said, I'm just going to sit here and be chill. And I said, I'm sorry, but my general doesn't like you. That's a flavor text joke. The flavor text on Grimlock is me, Grimlock, no like you. So the point is, Grimlock only has one mode, which is pedal to the metal. That game was a colossal beating. But then the next game I played was with my old standby. This is not one of the decks I mentioned before. Very old deck of mine, which is Glissa the Traitor.
Ooh, Glissa.
Glissa is just heavy removal and heavy card draw slash value through artifact recursion, of course. That's what she does. But the reason I wanted to play her is because I recently added Revelin Riches from
Ixalan. Oh!
Which I did get into play and would have won the game with if my opponent didn't just concede. The reason they conceded was because after some good back and forth with creature removal, fighting against Karthus and Rubinia, those were my two opponents, we had some good back and forth with some removal here and there, but I started to pull ahead until I put Glissa into play and equipped her on subsequent turns with Thornbite Staff, Viridian Longbow, and Swiftfoot Boots, which meant she was hexproof, Death Touch, and she could ping a creature for one damage, and whenever a creature dies, she becomes untapped.
She was the Golden Sharpshooter, basically.
Exactly. So, for any targetable creature of any size, right? So, basically, I let one of my opponents kill the other. I let Karthus kill Rubinia because she couldn't attack me. And then, I just kind of said, we don't really need to play this out. Even though I did have Revel in Riches and could easily have won that way. So that's just Glissa doing Glissa things against other creature-based strategies.
Sheesh.
Yeah. So those were the two games I played last night. And that's kind of an example of how things go in my play group, is I don't have turn two or three combo decks. I've built a couple of those in the past. That's completely no fun for anyone. My decks are now kind of value-based, trying to fight on slightly more fair axes, creature combat and removal, that kind of thing. But the problem is my card pool, my collection is so deep and old that I don't have a problem building any deck I want. And also my experience is very spiky. I take a kind of competitive bent towards when I build decks. What that means is I can build a theme deck like Grimlock and still have it be better than these people with their modified Krikons and things like that.
Damn. Mixa, you got a story?
Well, so my commander of the week will be KNT of Miletus. Tell Kevin what it's all about. So most people, when they think about KNT of Miletus, they think of a group hug deck, because sure, he draws everyone cards, he lets people put mana into play. But I look at him as, you know, he says, I draw a card and I ramp. So the only logical way I see this going is to just play big stuff and swing to wing.
Sure.
So he is filled with all those crazy big legendary creatures I don't put in my other decks, like Razia or, you know, all the Akroma's Memorial, some big dragons.
Nixa has a really soft spot for how was the Boros Angel called again?
It is Razia.
He has a really soft spot for her, so.
Razia is so cool. I mean, she's just really, really cool.
Anywho.
Okay, getting off track. So, And I played with Igor and some other people, and I turned out to be public enemy number one again, because Oath of Druids is more stupid in my deck than in any other.
Actually, nice. I quite liked it when I was playing with my deck. I really didn't mind you giving me free creatures.
Yeah, he was getting free creatures, and I was getting free Praetors, I was getting free Dragons, free Angels, yeah, that's totally fair.
Part of the problem was that my creatures ETB and mostly murder things, so it a bit balanced him out. Not a lot, but still balanced him a bit.
Yeah, the problematic part was when Avacyn landed, and then he couldn't get rid of anything anymore.
Oh, yes.
Until the Fiend Hunter made an appearance.
Yeah. that kind of stopped me a bit.
A bit.
And I was just starting to attack with a melded hand weird, the writhing
mass or whatever?
Yeah, the writhing township.
Nice.
I melded them and then just started to swing at people and then swung at me and killed me. You know, three alpha strikes.
I've never melded a creature in EDH.
Three alpha strikes from players tend to kill people off.
I mean,
right.
So yeah,
I did a finishing blow on you with the mirror entity, and then Tess, my girlfriend, turned around and proshed me, basically.
I like how prosh is a verb.
Prosh is such an annoying general.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm a masochist, and I actually got her the wannabe gas cradle.
Itlamok?
Yes. She played it last night. It was painful. Turns out, when you mana screwed but managed to play Prosh with that thing out, you kind of win the game.
Right.
Anywho, is it time for my commander of the week?
It is.
So, first, before I even start talking about some games, I did the big overhaul of my Alesha Who Smiles at Death and Taxes Primer. So you can all, if you want, take a look at that in the link section. Reworked it a bit. I think I screwed coding a bit looking at the page now, but alright, I'm going to have to fix that. But anyway, I've changed a lot of things with the deck, and now Tapped Out says it's 70% casual, so it's safe to play with people. It's not. It has Armageddon, it has impending disaster, things like that, and it's apparently 70% casual, so I don't know what the hell is happening with that page.
Well, you see, that's why I have the fairest deck of them all, my 99-card combo Karador. That is 99% casual, and it's called 99 card combo because I made it so it has only permanents, so the, what's it called, I keep forgetting.
Primal Surge.
Primal Surge just drops the deck.
Oh, nice. So, yeah. I thought you were going to say Hermit Druid.
Oh, no, he's not going to go those lines.
Primal Surge is the combo. That's
The thing about Nyxia, Kevin, Nyxia likes to play things interesting. He doesn't want to, you know, make him super efficient like Hermit Druid. If he's going to have a combo, it's going to be really interesting, and, you know, he's going to set some boundaries at him.
I was even thinking of adding Approach the Second Sun in Karador, just so people can't say that you just play one card and win, and it can fizzle. There's a chance it can fizzle then. And if it fizzles, well, I still... when it fizzles, I can't cast Approach anymore. But Approach would be a secondary win condition as well.
That's pretty awesome.
There's always Eternal Witness, Nyxia.
Primal Surge exiles the card.
Oh, god damn it, I forgot that. Well, in that case, get something like...
I can get from Beyond, but that's also also cause the fizzling.
Rift Sweeper, Nyxia. It doesn't fizzle.
Oh, well, there you go.
There you go.
Yeah, let's not go this deep because I'm afraid we're gonna get the blue Tron scenario again.
Voltron Tron of the God Tron scenario. Yeah.
Let's move.
Anywho, I played the game against Tess the other day. She was playing Prosh. I played the Alesha. Turns out when you equip your creature with the Dowsing Blade, and then Armageddon the whole field, you kind of win those games.
Dowsing Blade? What do you mean?
No, Dowsing Dagger, sorry.
Dowsing Dagger, yeah, okay, yeah. Gotcha. That makes sense. Yes, you have a fantastic land post-Geddon, sure.
I'm surprised how powerful the play is, and I'm really liking it, even though people are hating my Armageddon plays, but screw them.
I certainly would.
The people I'm playing with mostly are playing more power decks, like my girlfriend plays Food Chain Prosh.
Yeah.
So it's perfectly alright in that kind of environment to play Armageddon.
I would say so. Power begets power.
I played with Alesha last night against more casual people and my girlfriend. And I decided not to kill lands or things like that. Just, you know, to dial it down a bit. I still killed a lot of stuff, but I didn't kill the lands. So, but when I'm playing with that, with my normal playgroup, all bets are off and I can just do whatever I want.
Right. That reminds me of one of the things that I've tried to instill in my playgroup filled with younger or more budget conscious players, and that is non-land mana acceleration. For some reason, these players who have two color decks are still resistant to putting a Signet in, for example.
And
I don't know. I'm at the other end of the spectrum. I want to build my deck. Most of my decks that I build now have 20 artifacts in them, no matter what they are, just because there's no better feeling than playing Land, Mox, Diamond, Signet on turn one.
Unless, you know, Vandalblast happens. In that case, you're really sad, but...
That's true. Vandalblast would be good against almost all of my decks, and no one plays it.
I'm searching for a spot in my Alesha deck for that. I'm not sure what to put instead of it, though, but...
Do you two ever watch Brian Weissman's YouTube videos?
Personally, I do, yeah.
I like his stuff. He is a serious proponent of Vandalblast. It's so funny to see how highly he prizes that card.
Mm-hmm. He usually plays Nin and things like that, Embraer, right?
Exactly.
Anywho...
What do you think about Dousing Dagger? Do you think it goes in a lot of decks?
Yes. If your deck is creature heavy and has evasive dudes, play it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a perfect fit for my ninja deck because it's full of evasive creatures because...
Of course.
And it's a dagger, so ninjas can use that.
Yeah.
Basically, that ninja deck, it's a Sig River Cutthroat deck. He has all the ninjas and plenty of, you know, swords of X and Y.
All the swords, except all Body swords. And Mind, because and Mind is... I learned that most of the time, Body and Mind helps my opponent more than it hurts him.
Yes, yeah. if he would attack me with that creature with that, I would say yes, no blocks, please.
Yeah, if I could start every game with half my library in my graveyard, I think I would.
Oh my god, I would love that so much.
That's why I love Karador so much. I just have a second hand.
Yeah, with him. Nixia knows my decks and my playstyle. It's almost all the time. It's graveyard centric. I would like playing with graveyards.
Okay, okay.
I don't know why, but it's just such a fun feeling.
It's just another resource, right? There's just nothing better than Eternal Witness and Crucible of Worlds and Goblin Welder. I mean, yeah.
Value is a really good.
Yeah, basically I do two things. I play with graveyards and I deny resources to my opponents. That's two things I do.
Right, right. It's one of the things that I... Jeez, it doesn't seem that overpowered at face value. It's not a game-ending combo or anything. But because of my collection being the way it is, I can afford things like Crucible of Worlds and Rings of Bright Hearth and Fetchlands, which, you know, those cards don't win you the game directly, but when I play so many games with people, when we get to the mid-game and they've got 6 or 7 basics out, and I've got 10 or 11 dual lands in play, maybe not that many, but still, a ton of dual lands in play, there's no better feeling than returning a Fetchland from your graveyard and activating it and then copying it with Rings of Bright Hearth.
One thing and a small effect, Aven Mind Sensor. Just that small thing.
That's true.
I had him in play for like 6-7 turns yesterday, and people were so gimped by it. it came to that point that where guy had to cast the Diabolic Tutor just to get anything. Right. And he had to look at top 4 and he was like, shuffle.
That reminds me of the card Thalia, Heretic Cathar.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another one of those things that, you know, when you're playing against people who are playing precons, that kind of thing, it tends not to affect players with that kind of collection and those kind of decks.
Yeah.
Because their dual lands frequently already come into play tapped. I played a game a couple weeks back where someone played Thalia on turn 3, and they had played before me, so I'd only had 2 turns. And I looked at my hand, and it had a couple of dual lands in it, and I thought, okay, one of them was a shock land. I can deal with this, right? 7 or 8 turns later, every one of my lands had come into play tapped for the rest of that game.
Yep.
And every other land, every other non-basic that my opponents had played, which came into play tapped, would have come into play tapped anyway. So I was the only player who had been affected by that Thalia at all, and none of my opponents even noticed. Ultimate dagger was that no one noticed that that card had only affected me that game.
You know, it's also this the card in the same vein that affects really good decks really hard, but casual decks don't get touched by it at all. Turnisphere.
Oh, yeah, good point.
Yeah, I played against friend's Cranko deck, and I managed to land Trinisphere on like turn 2 or 3. and that held him at bay for the whole game. Usually I fall to that deck because he's too fast.
Right.
This Dentrinisphere just kept him, you know, he couldn't do anything properly. He casts Goblin Pile Driver, 3 mana. Every other Goblin, 3 mana. And that just, you know, that just made him fold the game.
But that's interesting.
If I was playing against a casual deck, they wouldn't... Okay, Rampant Goat would cost 3 mana instead of 2. There we go.
Right. That's an interesting point, and that really favors certain types of decks and certain types of collections.
Yeah.
I hadn't really considered that before. Trinisphere is kind of a nice... It's not very budget. I mean, you can get them for $7 or $8, it looks like, but that's a decent way to fight heavily powered decks, and it also obviously shuts off combo completely.
Yeah. Most combos. It was fun when I played against a girlfriend on, like, turn 2 due to Soul Ring and things like that, and she had a couple of mana dorks in her hand.
Yeah.
She was just like... what do I do now?
Yes, that would seriously hinder many of my decks.
But yeah, the primer is updated. I put a link on Reddit and had a couple of nice comments. I had a guy commenting, is this a casual deck? And he linked me his Alesha deck. And it's basically Alesha Vintage. I was like, yeah, I don't have that kind of money.
But it was what are the things that separate the two?
All of the Moxen he can play, Ancient Tomb, all those really fast mana kind of things.
Gotcha.
Imperial Recruiters, etc., etc., etc.
Oh, yeah.
My list is like $300-something, but I can make it, you know, much cheaper if anybody wants to play this kind of deck, but cheaper, that can be done really easily for like maybe $200-$150, and you can do it much more expensive. Again, this type of list. Because I just wanted to recreate the Death and Taxes in EDH.
Gotcha.
It can win, I don't know, due to some combos, but it usually plays a fair game, keeps people, you know, with the combo pieces at bay, and tries to smash people in the face.
You know,
You were going to say something, Misha?
I was just thinking Ancient Tomb is an interesting card because it can go in so many decks.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize that it's moderately expensive. Looking at the prices on TCG, it looks like $25-$30. But I think Ancient Tomb is the sort of card that would be a good investment for a player who's looking to take the next step in their collection to improve their mana bases and things like that, just because it's only a bit more than a shock land.
Yeah.
And it can go in so many decks. Shock lands are great, don't get me wrong, and I would advise people to work toward collecting shock lands in the long run, but an Ancient Tomb might be more useful than any single shock land in all of the collection of multiple decks.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing I would advise to people if they're improving their mana base is to get all the duels that just came recently out of Battle for Zendikar.
Sure.
Those are really good.
Yeah, there's plenty of great duels that have been printed in the last several sets, right? I mean, the fast lands aren't amazing in EDH, but they're playable. The buddy lands that have been reprinted in Ixalan are great duels.
The fast lands, I really, really love those, honestly. Because they come into play for me untapped when they're most important, like turns 1, 2, and 3 when I need to set things up.
Well, that's fair. And certain decks that are fast, like Alesha, can be fast. That's totally reasonable.
And the battle lands are just wonderful if you know have A, duels, B, just normal basics.
The buddy lands are fantastic. You mentioned the Battle for Zendikar lands. There's the cycling ones that were in Amonkhet. Those are fantastic.
I don't have those in my deck because they're coming into play tapped anyway. I just might actually get one or two, though, because cycling is an upside.
I agree, but those Battle for Zendikar lands were a real coup.
What's
an example of one of those?
Smoldering Marsh.
Threaded Pools. No, it's a cycling one.
Smoldering Marsh.
Smoldering Marsh, there you go.
It's like $150, something like that.
Yeah, they're so affordable. And also, those and the Buddy Lands especially, those two cycles are especially friendly to people who are starting from scratch. People who are starting from three-color decks that have 25 basics in them, right? Because they play so well with other basic lands.
Also, if you're speaking about lands, you know what's the land most decks should get? A Ghost Quarter. Nice, cheap, but it solves some really problematic things.
Yeah, it's a good role player. It can even fix your mana in a pinch.
I actually did that yesterday. I really needed a second white to cast my Sun Titan, so I end of turn I killed my own mountain or something like that to get a plane.
Yep.
And then you got that mountain back with this.
No, I think I actually got Necro or something like that, with some item.
Yeah, you know, basic mountain necropotence, so they're comparable.
I mean, necropotence is going to get me mountain anyway.
Well, you do have that new ghost quarterish land from Ixalan now as well.
I'm not going to play that in Alesha.
That well, land seems...
multiplayer games, it's actually not good because it ramps everyone.
That's why.
It's like it's more political than anything, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. If I were if I'm playing a deck that's less mean than Alesha, yeah, I would actually consider that because I want to make people, you know, like me. With this deck, I know people won't like me at all, so I'm not going to hide.
Oh, don't worry about that whole making people like you. It's never going to happen. I mean, I tried to make people like me. When I played Zedru, it doesn't work out. It just doesn't.
Okay, to be fair, you played Zedru after you played the mean Zedru. First he played the bad gifts one, and then he played the good gifts one, but still, damage was already done.
You have two different Zedru decks?
No, he had first the bad one, and then he got a reputation. He was like, people, I'm gonna play a nice deck now, and he pulled that out, and was like, we've seen this movie already, die.
It's like, I just give a Trojan horse to someone, and they're like, yeah, I don't want this. Go away.
That reminds me of what happens when I pull out Derevi. I have Derevi, and people look at Derevi, and they say exactly that. Oh my god. They say, no, this is Bird Tribal. And then everyone smiles and says, oh, okay, that's fun. And then I completely destroy them, because it turns out the Bird Tribe is actually pretty good.
We have a friend that it's all about the bird.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. It is one of my favorite decks because it's so unassuming.
His deck isn't what you would say good, but it's fun.
Yeah.
It can be really powerful because, you know, birds.
Yeah. If you play against people who don't play removal too.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wrath of God takes down the birds pretty effectively.
Mm-hmm.
We have like a constant. Like a rivalry with birds against scarecrows.
Nice.
But one thing that hurts Nyxia the most is that there is no legendary worm. That's his pet peeve.
Well, until Derevi.
Not a worm. Nyxia likes worms.
Worm. I'm sorry. I thought you said bird. Yes, you're right. No legendary worm. That's a shame.
And not the worm, the descendant of dragon worms.
With a U, not with W-U-R-M.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. That reminds me, it's funny. My friend Kirsten, who I mentioned earlier, has an insect tribal deck with Zeraarian.
Oh.
And we like to joke about how birds are the natural predators of insects.
Yeah, your deck should begin like at least 8 life, his should be 20, because, you know, insects.
That's right. Exactly.
That's only fair. We should play like a game of actual flavor EDH. You play a card, but then everybody has to decide how the flavor goes. Which card wins?
Nice.
I attack you with my demon, but your bird has a sword, but birds can't actually carry swords, so that doesn't matter. Things like that.
Yeah.
The thing I wanted to ask you is, do you have any deck that you normally don't play, but when people start being, you know, when somebody crosses the line, and you just have to, you know... I don't know, punish them or something? For instance, for me, that's my scarecrows.
Yep.
But I still don't play them in a combo-y way yet. They're still relatively, I'm going to say relatively fair, because they still lose to a Torpor Orb or to graveyard removal. But generally, when a playgroup starts being, you know, some people have something most of us don't like, I just take out the scarecrows and I start killing lands, if nothing else. And then I kill all my scarecrows, and then every scarecrow comes back, and then I kill everything again. And then Panharmonicon comes, and I kill everything twice.
I have done that
with Glissa, but it's not for the... It's not quite for the reason that you mentioned. It wasn't because someone was doing something too overpowered or inappropriate or anything. I got annoyed one evening during a play session with a player who brought a really slow, dirtly Mael deck. And it's one of those decks where it's filled with creatures that cost 6, 7, and 8 mana. And if you don't get a specific combination of things going on, you can't basically do anything with that deck, right? You have to have Mael or a short list of other cards. And this one particular game, it was Lurking Predators. Lurking Predators is a ridiculous card because it rewards you for putting for filling your deck with uncastable stuff. And sure enough, over the course of just 3 or 4 turns with Lurking Predators in play, this person got like 35 mana worth of creatures into play or something like that. But also, he was not attacking. He was not killing people. He was just kind of sitting back with this enormous army of things nobody could reasonably deal with.
Why?
Well, some players are political. Some players don't want the game to end. Some players don't want to be the one that kills anyone. There's every play group has people like that. That's why I brought out Glissa that one day.
I mean, if you're not going to be the one that smashes people with creatures, why put huge creatures in the deck?
Because have big creatures out.
Yeah, also, some people just want to collect large creatures.
Niksha, I bet it would feel nice to actually use the Lurking Predators and have creatures pop out, wouldn't it?
Oh, they do pop up eventually.
Because he played a couple of games, and for like 6-7 activations, nothing happened.
Well, which general?
At least it puts lands on the bottom of the deck. It was in the KNT.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I'm sympathetic to that. I can't put Lurking Predators in most of my decks because I don't play enough creatures. I have a healthy amount, but I would hit lands and signets all day.
Yeah, this is really good in KNT because it does have a fair amount of big creatures, and yet the commander actually rewards you for playing above average amount of lands because you can get rid of them very easily.
Sure, sure.
But then you show most of your lands. That's funny.
Yeah, but still, if I hit a land and put it on the bottom, I'm okay with that. I might draw into fuel then. And,
but you won't, because it's you.
And, what's it called? Sensei's Divining Top would be really good.
You should get them actually now, because they're on the cheap side.
Yeah, sure.
The tops.
Probably, I guess. I'll see. But if I play a top, that's one less big creature I can play.
Oh no, poor you.
I mean, where are going to put them in that case?
But it's that much faster that you'll get to that big creature, so...
I know.
Wild tops are cheap. $10.
Yeah, tops have become really cheap with the bannings.
Yeah, no kidding. So, going back to the heart of your question, though, I'm generally not faced with that situation because so few people in my metagame play with a truly degenerate or punishing kind of deck. There are a couple of people that have collections as old as mine who can build any deck they want, but they tend not to be very cutthroat. They tend to build decks like that Mael deck and some other things, or just goofy stuff like your KNT deck that you described. There's very few cutthroat kind of combo-y decks in our metagame.
And those decks, what are those cutthroat guys?
No, I'm saying the only one I can think of that's even close is Locust God. And the guy who plays that is not a cutthroat player. It's just that it so happens that the Locust God is ridiculous and it doesn't take much to build an enormous winning army.
It combos with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, very much so. Like Mazurek, right? It just, before you realize it, you've got 70 cards in your deck that are amazing. So, but really, even that deck and that player are not doing anything that's unfair or anything like that.
I mean, we need to first define what unfair actually is. So,
obviously, in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
There is certainly not anyone in my shop or my local metagame who has anything like a Stax deck, either Marin or Alesha.
We have a friend that plays Kefnet Stax, so that's a thing.
Oh, that's interesting. What's the heart and soul of that, then?
One of the things he does is Sunder.
Yeah, great.
He Sunders, or he can, get infinite combos with Palancron, etc., etc.
Sure, makes sense. Palancron is an interesting example of a card that I used to love and still have affection for, but I've actually removed it from every one of my decks because I realized that it was kind of just a game over button that, cast this when you feel like ending the game. And it never felt right to me.
I was never crazy about Palancron.
I think it's the right thing to do in a lot of scenarios, but I just it never felt right.
I when I'm going to play combos, I'm going to have to play combos with setup. Like, you know, I'm playing the Murderous Ratcap and Offenza combo in Alesha, but that actually requires setting things up.
Sure.
Even putting the Master Cult is in graveyard requires some setup, and then opponents see that it's in graveyard, and they can still respond.
Yep. I've reached the similar conclusion. I generally only play game-ending combos that are three or more cards.
I mean, I just like to work for it. That's the thing.
Yeah. I don't have Ashnod's Altar or Phyrexian Altar in my Mazurek deck, for example.
Ooh.
Because that's just like easy mode for that deck.
I really want to have a Phyrexian Altar, but that's so much money.
Yeah, that needs to be reprinted in quick yesterday.
That needs to be reprinted, yeah, a couple of sets ago.
Right?
Because it's a really nice effect. Ashnod's Altar is also good, but this gives you Color Man, and that's so much different.
Yes, absolutely. Phyrexian's Altar would be everywhere if it were $5.
I mean, then print it again.
I'm sure they will. It's probably already in the pipeline.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they put it in some supplemental product.
Exactly.
Because,
although it's getting a little expensive to be in the Commander product anymore.
Not necessarily. Black Market was also really expensive until they reprinted it.
Yeah, well, we can always hope.
It was like $20 at height. And then they just randomly printed the Black Market and it plummeted.
If they're going to do... Well, shoot. The thing is, Phyrexian Altar is not really that good of a card for any other format, right? It's not good for a Modern Masters or an Eternal Masters.
Yeah, something Commandery or, you know, Iconic. Yada yada.
Something like Iconic Masters. Well, there's a Magic 25th Anniversary set coming up, right?
I mean, it could be.
We don't know anything about what's in that.
We have no idea.
Well, we're completely sure that nothing from the reserved list will be there, so no Feldegriffs or anything.
Womp. Yeah, those random victims of the reserved list are the most infuriating things.
Didgeridoo?
Yeah, Didgeridoo and Feldegriff can be reprinted because of the sheer power of them. I mean, yeah. Something is okay. Collectors, I can see, you know, them being protected, you know, for duels and things like that. I don't agree with that position, but I can see where the people are coming from. But right. Feldegriffs and Didgeridoos, really?
No. Yeah. Well, it's just a testament that they didn't know what the secondary market would be like in 15 years. No one did.
Yeah, but they could back off now.
they certainly could.
But they're not gonna.
Sadly, no.
That makes me angry.
But we could get a transformed Didgeridoo in the next set. You know, search for the Didgeridoo.
Wow, that's a quest if I ever heard one.
What do you think of all the transform cards, especially the five lands? I know we talked about Dousing Dagger. What do you think about the five lands in EDH?
Oh, I think that all the transform cards from Ixalan are just amazing.
Yeah, I'm loving them. I'm playing with them. I got my girlfriend the Gas Cradle. I opened the search for the blue one on the pre-release. And that's actually been doing some work. The Primal Amulet is a godsend for Spellslinger decks.
That's
cool. The Primal Amulet actually allowed me to live the dream and actually cast the Factor Fiction and get two more copies. Because I had that and
that
I
feels
had...
Good.
Yeah, that was just wonderful. I still managed to lose the game, but barely.
I have a deck focused around copying spells that the Primal Amulet will go in once I get a copy.
Who is the Commander, Riku or...
No, the commander is Sliver Overlord.
Oh my god!
which is a joke because there aren't any slivers in the deck. I chose Sliver Overlord because it was five colors and because it's indestructible. I can just put it out there and not have to worry about it.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's just a five color spells based deck. It used to be who was the general before? It used to be Horde of Notions because that was funny too. But it turns out Sliver Overlord is a little more robust, and I have a foil one now.
I'm going to make my cast deck into a, you know, doubling spells deck, so...
We can compare notes.
Yeah, basically I needed a finisher in that deck, and I managed to trade the Torment of Hellfire from Nyxia. So I think I'm set now.
That's cool.
If I copy the Torment of Hellfire with X being like 5, like twice, it's going to be a good game.
Oh, gee, that card is so rude.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that in my deck. I just don't want to do that to people.
Why?
I'll tell you what I do want to do to people though. my favorite card in that Sliver Overlord deck is Radiate. It's basically a Radiate deck. My goal is to get any one of a number of things to Radiate. My absolute favorite is Master the Way.
Really?
You know that card?
I do. Just tell people what it does. Oh my god.
Master the Way is 3 red blue sorcery. Draw a card. Master the Way deals damage to target creature or player equal to the number of cards in your hand. So you cast Master the Way and then you cast Radiate, which copies a spell for all of its legal targets. So suddenly you're casting Master the Way on every creature and player. And you stack them such that the first one resolves on you. So you target someone else, but then you radiate it and the top copy goes at you. And the next couple copies go at your creatures. And then by the time it's resolved against you and your creatures, hence Sliver Overlord is indestructible, right? By the time it's resolved against those, then you start resolving it against every creature in play, and then you end with all of your opponents. And by the end, you draw a card when each copy resolves. So by the time it's resolving on your opponents, you should have a hand size of like 12, 13, 14, 15 against them. In some games, it's even more. If the board is full of creatures, for every one creature, that's another one damage that basically every one of your opponents take.
Okay, that's maximum jankness. I like it.
Well, plus the deck is filled with other good, like, bounce draw things like Repulse and Cryptic Command and such. So there are tons of things that are good to radiate.
Screw those cards. This is the thing.
Well, I agree. That's why I brought it up first. but you know what? The coup de grace, though. The coup de grace. And I always like to set this up with a little bit of magic trivia. And that is, do you know that there is only one card in all of Magic? There's only a single card that does this. A single card that grants you an additional turn, but is also targeted.
What? Wait.
There's only one card in Magic that grants you an additional turn and is a targeted spell.
Which one?
Part the Water Veil.
Oh, yeah.
Because it has Awaken. So you can cast Part the Water Veil with Awaken, targeting one of your lands, and then radiate it, and it will target all of your lands, and you'll get an extra turn for each one of your lands.
What?
Oh, and all of your lands are now 6/6s.
But that's less important, honestly.
I agree, it is less important, but it's also part and parcel of the whole story, so...
Wow.
Yes, so the big finish in that deck is to radiate Part the Water Veil and then kill everyone. And a card that made that combo even better, if such a thing is possible, is when they printed Cascading Cataracts. Because Cascading Cataracts is a 5-color land that's indestructible, so I could target that with my Waterfall, which means they can't disrupt it with a Wasteland or a Strip Mine. It's fantastic.
And people wonder why I play Armageddon, that's why.
I've done that once in my life.
But
I've radiated the one that targets Cascading Cataracts only once in my life. I've radiated the Water Veil a couple of times.
Wow, you're really living the high life, aren't you?
Right? See, that's what I'm talking about. I don't pull that deck out very much because that is a classic Dirtle deck. I just sit there, people are like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm not doing anything. I have this 5/5 indestructible creature, but I'm not attacking anyone. And then you just kind of play a flurry of spells and the game ends. So I don't play that very much.
You just play to get style points.
That's right. That's exactly right. And to copy as many spells as I can. It also has all the fork effects in it. So when I haven't found Radiate yet, I still just fork my Fact or Fiction, as you said, or my Repulse or my Cryptic Command just to get tons of value.
I honestly think that Fact or Fiction is my favorite thing in the entire game.
It's very fun to cast and fun to resolve. It's one of the few spells that's hurting you, but still fun to resolve.
I don't see how it's hurting me, honestly.
I just mean your opponents, when you cast it, one of your opponents has to make the choice, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That's what I mean. It's still fun to do.
My girlfriend has a really good strategy to combat Fact or Fiction. Uh-huh. She takes the 5 cards, she turns them face down, shuffles them, and gives me 2 piles. fun fact, it actually turns out that I need to think about those 2 piles for a while.
Most of the time, yeah.
Yeah, he just managed to do it, but she's just like, I don't want to think. other friend, the one who plays Goblins, is usually, oh, you're playing Fact or Fiction? Okay, here's 5-0 split.
Yeah.
I'm just like, that's not fun. Come on, dude.
That's an interesting political strategy because it makes you basically the enemy, even though they're the one choosing the 5-0 split.
Mm-hmm.
It's good politics.
There was times that I actually took the 0.
I can see that.
Sometimes you want those things in your graveyard, and you're just like, okay, let's do it.
Right, right.
What is actually, Kevin, your favorite thing in Commander, favorite card?
Oh, favorite card. Wow, that's interesting. Boy, I'm trying to think. I mean, Sol Ring is in almost every deck, right? But that's not my favorite card. I like drawing it, but...
Yeah, but what's the one thing that you drew it and just like, yes, this is the thing? To me, it's the Factor Fiction. I just love drawing that and playing it. What's your thing that causes you to be really hyped?
Boy, that's interesting. I'm trying to think back to all my days playing Zagana, and when I would draw up my hand and think, oh, yes, I'm finally going to get to this. And I think it started with, I mean, there's been plenty of great cards over the history, of course, but Rishkar's Expertise is now very, very high in my book just because of how filthy it feels to resolve that card.
That's spicy, that one.
Yeah, it feels so much like cheating.
I mean, it is, especially when my girlfriend casts it and then she eats a couple of kobolds.
Right.
Then just like, she used to play Shamanic Revelations instead of that.
Right.
And then they printed the Rishka's Expertise.
It's a huge upgrade.
Yeah, she swapped two of those and never looked back.
It just so happens, too, that Time Warp costs 5 mana.
Oh, jeez, man, come on.
Yeah. I know that Time Warp is pretty well hated by a lot of ADH players, and I don't blame them, but there's just nothing better than taking another turn, right?
I mean, I'm honestly not hating. Honestly, if it were up to me, the ban list would be much, much smaller, if they ask me. Fair.
I agree, too. There's plenty of 8 and 9 mana spells on there that have no place.
You mean Coalition Victory?
Well, that's one of them.
Even.
Oh, Grizzle Daddy, no. Grizzle Daddy would stay.
I think that we should be allowed to play with, what, Worldfire? Or,
Yes.
What's the other one that's blue that costs a zillion mana?
Sea of the Stars.
That's the one. Wow, I mean, good grief. If you're going to play 8 or 9 mana for a thing, you should be allowed to pay for it.
Yeah. Or Biorhythm as well, honestly.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
You destroy all creatures, play a creature, cast Biorhythm, somebody kills a creature. There we go.
Yep, exactly. I don't think that's any worse than someone having Animar in play and playing some free creature over and over again.
Or, you know, Ad Nauseam resolving.
Yeah, Ad Nauseam is a good one. Good grief. I can't have that card in a Child of Alara deck that has 60 lands in it. That's just totally unfair. That's the original Rishkar's Expertise right here.
That's an even better one than Rishka's Expertise, I think.
It, more powerful, I agree completely. And yes, it's filthy. You should never lose when you resolve Ad Nauseam.
Most time when you play it, you're just going to win. Or, you know, Protean Hulk has been unbanned. Why not unban a couple more things?
Yeah, agreed.
And
I'm the sort of person who thinks that if you aren't willing to put an answer in your whole 99 or a couple of answers to some 8 or 9 mana spell, then you should lose to an 8 or 9 mana spell, right?
Yeah, definitely.
That's okay. I have no problem. Tooth and Nail is already legal, right? Why is Tooth and Nail legal and Worldfire's not?
If Tooth and Nail is legal, I want my braids back.
Exactly.
But not as a commander. I want it just as a part of the 99.
Yeah, I agree. I think braids is fine as part of the 99.
Because why is braids legal in one-on-one commander, but she's legal in multiplayer?
Well, one-on-one is... It's a considerably different animal, in my opinion.
But that's the thing. She deals much more damage in one-on-one games, right?
Well, that's fair. She's incredibly disruptive.
In multiplayer, you should be able to... You have 3 players that are going to kill her. That's the thing.
Well, maybe. I don't know. If I played Braids on turn 4 in my group, I think a lot of people might just concede. There's so few people who play good answers to even cheap creatures.
But see, this might actually force them to put a couple of murders or things like that.
Yeah,
I mean,
maybe.
It still doesn't really matter. I mean, I have plenty of removals in some of my decks and I still redraw them.
Yeah, but would a turn 4 Braids disrupt your whole deck?
Which deck? Hellish.
Well, mostly all of them, except...
Then you need to play more removal,
I tend to... I'm building decks with so many cheap permanents these days that by turn 4 I should have 6 or 7 or 8 permanents.
That's a fun thing. I was watching on Tapped Out a couple of my deck lists, and then I came to my girlfriend's Prosh, and I was like, wow, this is an expensive deck. Average CMC is 3.6. That's average CMC, and that's expensive
high.
In my mind.
Yeah.
My normal decks
one
are
of my
like,
favorite things.
Yeah. Finish.
I was going to say that one of the things I discovered that I loved only in the last 2 years or so is playing mana elves in EDH. There was a long time when I never did, but now I just love nothing more than turn one land war elves go. It feels so good.
That's unfair.
I used to think, why would you bother? People, you know, Worldfire is banned. What do you need to play on land war elf for? Just play something else. And then I realized, oh yeah, this format does reward speed.
Girlfriend plays it in her brush. Yep. And turns out when you're facing a turn three brush, that's not fun.
Exactly.
And that's yeah, the only
My Timna Thrasios deck has Land of War Elves, Birds of Paradise, Elves of Deep Shadow, the one from Innistrad that taps for white, which I forgot the name of, and Noble Hierarch. Yeah, I think I've got 5 1 mana elves in that deck.
And would you like to play some more?
Maybe. It kind of depends. Mm-hmm. I don't have the copy of Land of War Elves, the Fiendhorn Elves. I don't have that, so I do have another one that I could play.
How come but you still, don't have those?
Well, I had to make cuts somewhere. The deck is filled with creatures. I want to make sure I can have evasive creatures too. None of those elves are evasive, so.
Good point.
I mean, it is a Timna deck, so I need to get through. So.
I'm really falling in love with Timna.
Oh, she's so good. Turns out I think she's my favorite of the generals from that year.
If I could, I would actually put her as a partner with Alesha, but I can't.
Right? That would be amazing.
Because whenever I draw her, I'm just like, yes.
Do you and your playgroups have positive or negative feelings about the whole partner mechanic?
We actually don't have any feelings about them. I haven't seen partner commander since Vile Smasher got banned.
Marco plays her, our friend who plays Captain Stax. He plays the Thrasios, and what's the other chick? The Prophet of Rufix chick.
Oh, Kaidel?
Yeah, he plays that in his stupid combo deck.
Okay.
He just gets all the possible mana rocks, the Paradox Engine, and just draws his old deck out with Thrasios. Right.
Yeah, Paradox Engine is a pretty nasty beast and is definitely in my Timna Thrasios deck, and it frequently results in playing a dozen cards a turn. It's a summative combo in my estimation. The Paradox Engine is obviously the linchpin, but you have to have a half dozen other things in play to really make it that potent in my deck.
So, with people saying that it should be banned, you're against that, or...?
I'm on the fence. It's one of those things where it can be the linchpin in just a number of degenerate strategies, but again, no one in my area even has Paradox Engine in a deck because... As I said before, they don't feel like putting very many mana rocks in their decks. A lot of people in my playgroup would look at Paradox Engine and say, what does this even do? I look at it and I realize it's totally degenerate, but most of my people just don't have that approach to building mana bases.
That's the center of my Drano deck.
Yeah.
If I can get that into play, I'm winning the game, and that's it.
Yeah. I have several decks that I don't even have the engine in them, but I am pretty sure that if I could get it into play, the game would just end. Zagana is another good example, because I have every creature and artifact in there that taps for multiple mana. All the stuff taps for 2 or more mana. I'm pretty sure that could just end the game.
Yeah, but you have to dedicate your whole deck to making it good.
Well, that's the thing. It's just my style to do so.
Yeah, but
most of my decks, you could just slot it in.
That's why I'm being like, it shouldn't be banned. Even though people are, you know, calling for that to be banned.
Yeah.
Because you really need to dedicate a lot to make it work. When it works, it's really, really good, but...
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I have a pretty high threshold for what should actually be banned in this format.
So what card that's currently unbanned would you like to see banned?
Sol Ring.
Oh yeah, I can see that.
Sol Ring is foolish. I mean, obviously, if you're building this format from the ground up, looking at the current banned list, looking at everything that's upsetting people in 1v1 and all this other jazz, you would never obviously allow Sol Ring in this format.
My line of thought is, if it's restricted in Vintage, you need to think about it for a bit.
You need to think about it, right. A better candidate, actually, would be Mana Crypt, because of the cost issue also, which I know Wizards is sensitive to. Mana Crypt is freaking expensive and incredibly good, and it's one of the things that most of the people in my playgroup are afraid to play. There's probably out of dozens and dozens of decks, there's probably just a couple, two or three maybe, that have a Mana Crypt in them in my whole play group. Aside from me, who personally owns a half a dozen of them and has them in most decks.
A problem with Mana Crypt is its availability and price. I think that's what's keeping it from being banned.
Well, that's the thing, though, is the fact that it's so scarce and expensive is the thing that's keeping most of my play group from playing with it. Yeah. They can't afford one. And even if they did, some people have one and are just like, I don't like that card. It hurts me too much, right? A lot of people still have they don't have the life as a resource mentality.
I mean, I'm used to thinking look, I'm going to get 3 damage per turn. That's okay. But if I kill everybody before that, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I've got 40 life. You realize how many turns that is?
You know how many cards that is with Necro?
Exactly. Exactly.
A lot.
Exactly. So now I genuinely think that the current banned list and how it revolves around mana, for example, in one, especially in 1v1, but how it revolves around expensive spells, and it should be at the other end of the spectrum. It should be that we have banned Sol Ring and Mana Crypt and Mox Diamond, and then you can play with all the World Fires and Sway the Stars that you want.
If they would unban all the Moxen from the ban list, would you be okay with that?
That's a weird thing. I own those cards. I would feel bad playing with them because no one else in my playgroup has them. My decks would immediately become just way too good. They're already way too good. They would become even better. And it would be a real sour taste in my mouth. But that, I think that begets the question of proxies, though, because I would have no issue if all the people in my playgroup proxied all these cards that they don't have. I mean, I play proxy vintage on an almost weekly basis. That's just kind of my thing. Proxies have such a negative stigma across the community that even these people who are scrapping and scrounging to buy a Shockland every week or two, they just aren't willing to proxy up a Gaea's Cradle, even though it's fantastic and fun. So I have a real split decision on that one. I don't think it's right for the format for a number of reasons, and I think it would be a net negative, even though it would make my decks awesome.
I mean, how many people would actually be able to play with the Mox? And that's the question.
A few thousand in the whole world.
That's the thing. But of those few thousand, how many play EDH?
The overlap is probably not very high. But
that's the thing. For the format as a whole, it wouldn't be that bad. For your play group, it might suck a bit.
Well, that brings into the whole social contract issue, right?
Yeah.
I wouldn't feel right bringing a 5 Mox, well, it would actually be a 7 Mox deck to my local game group. I mean, I just probably wouldn't even do that. I might do it for fun, but I would be cognizant of not overpowering the things I'm doing. Would Zagana like a Sapphire and an Emerald? Sure, that would replace 2 basic lands, but no one else in my playgroup, I don't think, would even do that. So I would feel real bad about it. And I also don't think anyone would metagame, right? A casual player might be into something like a Null Rod effect, although Null Rod's expensive too, or the Trinisphere that you mentioned before. I just don't think anyone would metagame either. They would just be like, yep, and now we're losing even worse.
Your group really needs to play the Vandal Blast.
Well, that's true. I would definitely recommend it to any of them that would listen to me. These kind of things, but people just don't see it. They don't appreciate it, I guess.
I don't think they're into it as much as like me or you are. That's the thing.
Yes, I think a lot of the people I play with, and it's, I think you're familiar as well, they still see the format through the lens of the Johnny or the Timmy stance, right?
Yeah.
Well, here's this new cool thing I can do. And I don't criticize that at all, but a lot of times what that leaves by the wayside is just what is efficient or what is good. And you two have already discussed off the air about the removal, the lack of removal in your metagame, and the same is true in mine.
Yeah, people, I mean, if they would just put a little bit more removal.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just
I was doing a lot of work last night in that Grimlock game I mentioned with Sword of Fire and Ice. I killed half a dozen creatures with it. It was incredibly strong.
Yeah, it adds up, doesn't it? That's small damage.
Yes. Especially when they're trying to chump block 6 power creatures with their elves or whatever.
Aww. Poor guys.
Well, like I said, Grimlock doesn't like you. I mean, it's not personal. It sounds personal, but it's not personal. He just doesn't like you.
He's just not a people person.
Exactly. I mean, if you were a robot dinosaur, Would you be a people person?
I wouldn't care about people because I'll be a robot dinosaur. My whole goals in life would be accomplished, I think.
Well, me, Grimlock, disregard you.
Well, you still wouldn't be, you know, Pirate Batman, but, you know, Robot Dinosaur is still a pretty...
Pirate Batman, what the hell? Although, there's a really interesting cross-section that I saw. Somebody combined Wolverine and Batman.
That's a pretty potent combination.
And I thought to myself, there is something similar in Warhammer 40k. It's a legion of space marines called the Night Lords. Basically, imagine a murder-happy vigilante for justice.
Okay.
A guy ruled the planet, which was basically a criminal scum pile. He imposed the reign of terror on it, and then suddenly there was no crime. Surprise, surprise. He turned his back for a couple of years. Suddenly there was crime again. He did the only sensible thing. And that was destroy the planet, because, you know.
Naturally.
And by sensible thing, I meant batshit insane, but, you know. Never much understood the whole hype behind Batman, personally. He was never my kind of a hero.
Well, yeah, I don't have any deep-seated affinity for him, but I do like the Batman movies as they began with Tim Burton.
What, you're not a fan of the Schumacher movies?
No, I mean, I don't deride them as much as most, but they're definitely pretty far down my list.
I mean, they're fun to watch. By fun, I mean funny.
Yeah, I would agree. If George Clooney had a second facial expression, I might be a little more into them.
Does he need one?
A lot of people would say no.
He's George Clooney. You know what I want to see? That's never going to happen now, but way before. What's his name? Scottish actor. He was the James Bond. I can't remember the name now. The first James Bond.
Not the first one?
Yeah.
I don't know who the first James Bond was off the top of my head.
Yeah, wait. He played King Arthur and all that.
Oh.
Sean Connery, yeah.
Yeah, he was certainly not the first James Bond.
Wasn't he the first James Bond?
No, there were several before him, but that's beside the point.
Are we sure? I think he was playing the first one.
But you're eliminating people like Roger Moore and those that came before him.
No, Sean Connery was the first one.
He was before all of the others?
Yeah.
I didn't think that he was.
Connery was the first one for like three or four movies. I can't remember. Wait. No, Wikipedia says 7 Bond movies. So, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I didn't remember that he did the 63 through 67 time period.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was the first one. But imagine him with his accent being the Batman. I'm Batman.
That'd be pretty ridiculous.
Although he would be really easily found in the city. Who's the other person who has the stupid accent? Oh yeah, Bruce Wayne. Speaking of, how can nobody recognize Superman and Clark Kent being the same person?
Well, that's a long-trodden theoretical question. And the answer is that they could. It's just, it's in the script.
I don't know, I think that people are just like being nice and ignoring it purposely.
Right.
Okay, Clark is being a nice guy and saving us all. Let's just ignore him being Superman.
I think it was Jimmy Kimmel who did a bit that addresses that exact point, where he's at a party in the Superman versus Batman universe from last year or the year before, and he has that revelation that, hey, you look like Clark Kent or whatever, or you look like Superman. Take the glasses off. And he's like, no. Anyway, you should look that up if you want to see that exact interaction happening.
I mean, the thing that proves it most that actually everybody knows is because he still has a job as a news journalist, but he's always going out to the office and doing Superman stuff.
Yep.
If they didn't know that he was Superman, he would get fired a long time ago.
Do either of you wear glasses on a regular basis?
Nope. Nick sure does.
I do.
Imagine if you lived your whole life and you could never take the glasses off because people would immediately recognize you as Superman. How annoying would that be? Well, like, you know, you just want to rub your temples or whatever, but you can't take your glasses off because you'd be taking your disguise off?
At that point? I mean, like, I'm sure that you can be alone at some point so you can...
go to the bathroom to rub your eyes?
Yeah.
Superman is weird.
Superman is not my favorite superhero by a long stretch.
Oh, he's boring as hell.
Exactly. I think they've tried really hard through multiple movies to make him more interesting, you know, the humanistic elements and that kind of thing, but it just, it doesn't work. It doesn't work for me.
I mean, it's really hard to actually humanize him. That's the thing.
It wouldn't be so hard if just making him have human conversations in human situations is not hard. It's just writing what is otherwise not a superhero movie is the problem.
Problem is he's basically Jesus. That's the thing.
Right.
And it's difficult to make Jesus seem, you know, human-like and approachable.
Vulnerable, too.
Yeah, because guess what? He's Jesus.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think that I haven't watched a lot of Superman movies, but I did watch one feature-length cartoon. It was Superman versus the Elite. And that one was actually pretty good at showing off what Superman is. Not this, that he wasn't this all-powerful, just Deus Ex Machina machine that can just solve everything without basically trying. But it shows, like, interesting part of his character, of his complete design. So I would watching that.
When you said Superman vs. the Elite, I had a picture of him fighting with Pokemon against the four Elite.
The Elite Four, yeah.
That would be a really nice movie to watch.
Well, if you put Superman in the larger metagame of superheroes, he does get outclassed pretty quick. So I guess there's that point. I'm not a superhero expert, but, for example, any of the people that have mind control or telekinetic powers pretty immediately trump him.
Well, he actually does have protection for that. He trained to have protection. So, yeah, he's not manipulated.
Well, some people have got to be able to still, right?
But he is vulnerable to magic, so Doctor Strange would be pretty effective again.
God Emperor of Mankind, I guess.
Yeah, if he wasn't dead.
He can still mind crush him with his magic, if need be.
I mean, if we were talking about the new Superman, the pre-crisis Superman was omnipotent, so he isn't even considered for anything.
Yeah, that's the thing I mind with Superman, because he's as powerful as he needs be for the story.
AKA boring.
Yeah, that's the thing.
What are your thoughts on Superman versus Hulk?
I don't know. I think that Hulk would stop being angry after a while.
Really? That's an interesting take.
While being, you know, a couple of days, he would just get bored by, you know, not being able to smush Superman.
Fair enough.
And that's
part of Hulk's character, right? Is he's not originally infinitely angry, despite what the Avengers would tell you.
Oh, yeah. It's because he can't physically be infinitely angry. Like, there is some real-world, like, limitations to how angry he can be. It just turns out that he can be angrier than anything else is because he has super-fast regeneration. So he can... So that's why he can be more angry than others.
His angry meter can recharge faster than anybody else's?
Yeah, but I don't know. But he can still burn out at some point. If he takes too much damage, then he can, like... He doesn't have the energy to regenerate his hate, basically, and he burns out.
I don't know, Niksha.
I played against a lot of people online. I think I've seen much angrier people than Hulk was. Sheesh, people online are goddamn. I never understood that part of the gaming community, being angry at random strangers on the internet.
I had a discussion with a friend. Actually, about that, I mean, it's kind of normal in multiplayer online games that you're, like, angry at other people because human nature says that, you know, you value yourself most of the time above everyone else, so if something's going wrong, you're going to blame other people, not yourself. Like, that's basic human. But what...
As Homer Simpson says, this is everybody's fault but mine.
Yeah. The interesting part starts at when you observe, like, single player games with online functionalities. Like, for instance, there's lots of anger in World of Warcraft, I guess. At least that's what I heard. But there isn't a lot of anger in, like, Guild Wars. Because Guild Wars, you can play it most of the time by yourself. And also when you party up with other people, it is easier, and nothing can really go wrong if you party up. I mean, there's very rarely something that can go wrong. So people tend to be a lot nicer in Guild Wars too, and I know that because I haven't really found any angry people in that game for like several years. So the weird part happens when you have people in single player games that can that play against other people and they still get angry. Like for instance, let's take Hearthstone. People are like salty and angry as all hell, and it doesn't make sense. They can't why blame anyone else? I mean, they can't blame anyone else.
They can be angry, but they can't really, you know, tell that to the other person.
Well,
the only thing they can do
still.
Is well played.
Yeah, you passive aggressively emote.
Yeah, but people still get angry, but those are things that are out of their control. In team playing games, there's the factor of your team, so you have something to blame. But in single player,
speaking of Hearthstone,
yeah.
Sorry, I wanted to ask you too about your thoughts about Magic Arena.
It seems nice, but I still haven't had a chance to actually play it because I'm still not in the beta. So
well, nobody is.
Marco got an invite today.
Oh.
Huh.
Yeah,
anyone had played it yet.
They started rolling the beta invites, I think, yesterday.
Hey, I'm a judge. Why aren't I auto-included in the beta? What?
Because judges don't know how to play Magic.
Oh, yeah.
They don't like your kind.
Wow.
Oh, because of all the lawsuits they attempted? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's a little bit of a tenuous relationship.
I like the interface. I mean, it's very Hearthstone-y, and that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Because
turns out Hearthstone works.
Yeah, they made a really good UI, and there's no reason not to try to be like it. I mean, of course, they're going to do something about the sound in general, because it can get a bit disruptive. I mean, too much sound can't be really good, but we'll see.
Any question?
Yeah, that's easy to configure.
How will it be able to emote in a similar level like Hearthstone can, or...?
Oh, I think that's still in development. I mean, I haven't played it, but I'm guessing you will.
Because I want to know how we'll be able to be passively aggressive to people who are beating us, because, you know, bad top decks and they're lucky and everything.
Maybe
I would imagine that we'll copy as much as Hearthstone as it can.
Maybe they'll put, like, the sound emotes, like, nice top deck and something like that.
Go die! Go die!
I like that the Planeswalkers will all have sound, so we'll finally be able to hear some for the first time.
That is interesting.
And Magic Community will get to hear Jace whine, I guess.
And I can't wait. I can't wait to hear the voice actor for Floral's Bosom.
I mean, Wizards, you can feel free to hire me to be, you know, the film's bosom voice actor, no problem.
Well, they can also take you as the FBF voice actor. FBF.
Nice.
I mean, I can do many voices, so, you know, that's not a problem.
Like
you're multi-talented?
For plant tokens, could you do plant tokens? That's a nice impression. Yeah, I agree.
Thank you. You can hear the roots grow.
Uh-huh. I really felt the growth.
Is there anything that's left for us to discuss? Because we've turned into, you know, much wider array of topics besides Magic.
Well, technically,
right.
We're still on the Commander of the Week section.
That is a good point, yes. We never transitioned into anything else.
In a manner of speaking.
So, Niksha, do you have a main
topic? So, what's
next? Niksha will think of a main topic.
Well,
I think that Niksha will think of a main topic.
What are your experiences? How did Ixalan affect Commander in your playgroup thus far?
Well, my personal experience, it's simply too early. People are excited about the flip cards, the lands, as we discussed earlier, and so am I think so. couple of people, I think, are building a dinosaur-centric deck, but it hasn't manifest yet. I'm the only one who's put a couple of cards in any decks, and they haven't really come up yet. I mentioned Revel in Riches and Glissa before. I put a new dinosaur. I put Regisaur Alpha into Grimlock.
Is there any source of Spyglass in your decks?
No, I'm not the kind of EDH card I would play. Are you going to play it?
Maybe, because it hoses some things, and that peak effect is really nice. Again, you guys were really hyped for Vintage, so...
That's true. It's going to be a pretty sweet Vintage card and pretty disruptive. Yeah, I don't enjoy that kind of effect in my EDH decks, but I can see why some people would.
Didn't it actually show up already in VSL?
Yes. In fact, Rich Shea got a complete blowout against Randy Buehler with it, because Rich had his one Sorceress Spyglass, and he drew it and played it on turn one, and Randy was holding his two copies of Flooded Strand, and so Rich was able to turn off two fetch lands in Randy's hand. It was pretty ugly.
And Kevin, you misspoke. It's the Rich Shea.
Yeah, you're right. It is the one and only, the Rich Shea.
But yeah, that's an effect I really like, just hosing random things. Like, I can look at the control player's hand and choose Kefnet, let's say.
Right.
And that's really strong, because he gets a lot of advantage from just, you know, drawing at the end of somebody's turn.
Yeah, I agree. It's pretty flexible and useful. Things that come to mind are Maze of Ith, right? Yeah, just flexible answers. Planeswalkers, of course. I can see why it would be a good card.
Yeah.
It's also a really good flavor card for pirates.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Absolutely. Otherwise, Ixalan is still a little bit speculative for me and mine. I've only opened one of the flip lands. Okay, take that back. I had a Conqueror's Galleon in my sealed pool, which is amazing, and I put that into Grimlock too. So that's a good card advantage engine there, and Recursion engine. I like the Conqueror's, I think it's Foothold. Foothold. So I did open that flip card. But the legendary lands, the only one I've opened is Vance's Blasting Cannons, which is exactly not my style. Red is my least favorite color in EDH, so I haven't put that into any decks yet. The other, the blue one I want to try, the green one obviously. The white one might go in one deck. The black one doesn't have a place in any of my decks. So I'm interested in getting a couple of them. Oh, Dousing Dagger went straight into Glissa. It does double duty in Glissa, because it gives them creatures that I can kill, which is hilarious. So I love Dousing Dagger. But so it's still an unknown quantity for the most part in my playgroup.
Well, still a bit too early.
The thing I was expecting is that I'll just see, you know, just a bunch of flavor pirates that would run Admiral Beckett Brass.
I have a friend who's building that, yep.
I was just expecting to see, like, a lot of people doing that. And I would be just, like, there, wow, yeah, you're so creative with your tribal pirates and things. And I've been playing Ramirez Del Pietra for years now.
That's a particularly neat example. Ramirez is my pauper commander general.
Niksha, you know what's one part that's actually stopping people from actually getting all the pirates? The cards have spiked because of that whole legacy 5-0-ing pirate deck that turned out to be a fluke.
The Popeye Stompy.
Yeah. The funniest part was when one streamer actually played the Stompy. And he got matched up in the league against the guy who actually, you know, popularized the whole Stompy thing from Channel Fireball.
Right.
And he actually managed to beat his elves with the pirates.
That was a pretty funny social media phenomenon, that whole Popeye Stompy thing.
Yeah, but prices still haven't dropped for a bunch of pirates.
And the Rashad and Brigand, right?
Yeah, I looked at I'm going to put a couple of them on Cardsphere, you know, to get maybe if somebody sell me some of the cheap pirates. Why are these cards $10 more? What the hell is this bullshit?
What are you talking about? What kind of pirates spiked?
The Rashad Brigand.
Mercadian Masks ones.
What? I have...
The masks ones that make people sack permanents unless they pay 1, 2, or 3 mana.
Yeah.
So the 1 mana guy is the one that spiked, like...
The Cut Curse, the Foot Pad, and the Brigand.
Yeah.
Wow.
1, 3, and 4 mana, if I remember correctly.
No, it's 1, 2, 3.
It's 1, 2, 3 in terms of what you have to pay to.
No, no, I meant the mana cost of the creature.
Yeah, they're 3, 4, and 5.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
But, yeah, those things spiked, even though they're not actually going to be a real deck in Legacy.
But most likely.
The irony is, as I was going
to
say, that's the high irony, is those cards are actually decent cards in Commander.
Yeah, they are.
They're not great, but they're decent cards.
Yeah, especially now that they have a really good Commander, which I'm not
exactly
going to play.
Nyxia's going to be all hipstery.
Yeah.
It's funny, I tend not to build a new deck with the newest generals when they come out. I just assume everyone's going to, and then very few people do. It took me a long time to build Hapatra, for example, which is now a deck that I really enjoy. But I didn't do it for months till that she had been out.
The generals I like to play are the ones that don't have, you know, one build and that's it. I like open-ended.
Yeah, true.
Because Hapatra is kind of a soul general, for most part.
She's definitely preordained with many of her cards, I'll give you
that.
Yeah,
you can't do much interesting things.
Right.
Scarecrow's also, they're more open-ended, let's say, Hapatra.
Yep, agreed.
Alesh, I've seen at least 5 or 6 deck types for that deck.
Alesh is pretty open-ended.
Yeah, that's the thing. Karador is also extremely open-ended. You can do whatever the hell you want with those colors, basically. And then there's Locust God, who just wants to, you know, cards that say draw a card.
Right.
There's a bunch of those.
Locust God and Hapatra have a lot in common in that regard, I think.
I'm still most impressed that Locust God can utilize Skullclamp really unfairly.
Oh, jeez.
Basically, that and Skullclamp and the Ashen's Altar.
Right.
Sure, why not? So,
yes, I do try to shy away from generals that are very prescribed in their builds.
What's actually the most prescribed general, the most closed one?
I don't know the answer.
Hapatra is on that end, but I'm not sure she's the most restricted one.
Possibly some of the mono-green generals, like Azuri.
Oh, yeah, Azuri might be one of those, because... And also Krenko.
Krenko, yeah, definitely. Very narrow and prescribed.
Basically, if it's a monocolored tribal, that might be the thing.
Yep. That's probably near the tip of that end of the spectrum.
Hmm.
A lot of people felt that way about Derevi early on, which is why there's such a negative response when I pull it out, but... I have proven that that's not necessarily the case.
Oh, that's not the case, but most of the time when you see the Revy, you know you're in for a world of hurt.
Exactly.
Nothing's going to happen for a long, long time.
You know, along that same spectrum, Azami.
Definitely Azami.
Yeah, so I think you're right. I think monocolored tribal is the most narrow.
The Azami is a special case, though.
I also think five-color tribal is pretty prescribed, like Sliver Queen.
Oh, yeah, definitely not, actually. I had a friend that played Sliver Queen, and in his deck there were like 2 or 3 slivers.
Well, it's got to be the exception, though, right? If you're trying to build the sliver deck, though, it's pretty prescribed.
But mostly, he just wanted to play a four-color deck, because he didn't really use the red. Actually, he used like red, like, but not a lot of it. And
there was red,
he mostly wanted a
four-color.
He mostly wanted a 4-color commander, and the 4-color commanders weren't invented yet.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of which, Atraxa.
Atraxa? Well, Atraxa has lots of builds.
I don't know, he meant he wanted to play Atraxa, but there was no Atraxa at the time.
Oh.
Yeah, Atraxa.
Because, you know, red
was super... Yeah, red, as I mentioned before, red's my least favorite color in the format. Atraxa was really... attractive to me when she was originally printed, but then I never built the deck because it's pre-built, obviously, so many people around me had it and immediately started making the Super Friends list, and so I just never did.
Yeah, I'm glad that Nyxia stopped playing Super Friends, because not because it's a bad deck or it's a really, really good deck, it's just it takes time for it all to resolve. And
sure.
That's something. I do this trigger with
the I forgot about all the...
You forgot?
Yeah, when you asked me about Ixalan, I forgot about all the new Planeswalkers. I put Hwatli into Grimlock, which makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm planning to put Vraska into Glissa, but I'm not 100% sure about that. And I genuinely want to find a home for the new Jace, but I can't think of where he's best in.
Oh, I found the perfect home for new Jace.
Yeah?
Oh.
Pirates.
Well, okay, I'll buy that. That makes sense.
Makes sense,
I really wish his ability triggered for each creature. I'm sad that they made it more restrictive than it needed to be.
I mean, he had to. He would be actually too powerful separate.
I guess looting, though.
I guess the solution is blink him a couple of times, then use the ability each time, and then attack.
Or, you know, ultimate him, so you can have multiple looting.
I mean, yeah, sure, you could be effective and do that. Or you could just do it like my solution.
How are each of you going to feel the first time you either pull off or see someone pull off Doubling Season plus Jace Cunning Castaway?
I'll be clapping. Especially if they have Anointed Procession and Parallel Lives in play.
Nice.
Then I'll be like, well played, sir, well played.
I mean, there are just so many better things to do with Doubling Season than a random Planeswalker.
Oh yeah, definitely, but
why would you put the Jace?
But it's so novel, though. You keep making copies of your Planeswalker? That's fantastic.
Nixia style points, that's why.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you couldn't do it before, but...
No, Nixia, you played in Temur colors, and then you get almost infinite number of Jaces, and then you have Impact Tremors, and just everybody produces Illusion. There we go.
That's another way, yeah.
That's ineffective as hell, but...
And
bonus, you get to call that deck Use Your Illusion.
Good God, I have all these stupidities for decks, but then whenever I start building decks, I can't force myself to build, you know, a bad deck. And that sucks.
That's just too much? You can't force yourself to do it?
No, I just started building decks, you know, good, and I can't stop building decks good. Whenever I build, you know, a nice, cutie deck, I'm like, okay, but I'll just put this, and this, and this, and oh my God, what the hell have I done?
Okay, tell me this. What's the jankiest card that you're playing with in any of your decks, but just because you like it or love it or what, that isn't a good card?
Let me see, what do I have in my Omnath, because that's my jankiest deck I have.
Oh man, this could actually take a while, yeah.
In Kess, it's that 7-mana enchantment that copies your spells.
Swarm Intelligence.
Yeah, that's janky as hell.
That definitely went in my copy deck, yeah. That's pretty janky. I like it. That's at least on theme still, right?
Oh, I found which one. Soul Blast. That's Soul janky. Soul Blast? Yeah. Three red instant. As an additional cost to play, Soul Blast sacrifices all creatures you control. It deals damage to the target creature or player equal to total power of sacrifice creatures.
Wow.
I played an Omnath, the angry one.
That's a serious beating. I remember this card now. I didn't remember it had been reprinted.
No, I just took the original printing. There was a reprint, but I had to go with the original printing, because original printing.
It's pretty awesome.
I'll be right
back. That's a good one.
For Nixia, it will take a while, because he likes a lot of jank.
Well, in the interest of giving him time, I think I already mentioned Master of the Way in my Sliver deck, which is pretty funny.
That's
a pretty janky card. But the best example is probably Stormcrow. I have Stormcrow in my Derevi Bird Tribal deck. And it's very imposing.
I mean, you can pitch it to Force of Will. It's the most powerful blue card ever.
Exactly.
I'm sad that most Magic players don't know why Stormcrow gets the reputation.
I know, right? 13 out of 10.
I mean, yeah, but when they explain that, like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But they're not impressed by it. But you can pitch it to Force of Will.
Do you play Force of Will in many decks?
If I had any, I would.
Okay, fair enough.
But I do not have Force of Will yet, but I might get one in some future.
Still ridiculously expensive for a card that's been reprinted recently.
Yeah, but at least that card is played in many formats.
This is true.
What I plan to
I
get
don't,
from...
I'm not a giant fan of it in EDH. I mean, obviously, I know in higher-powered metagames, it's an important tool.
Yeah.
But I only have it in maybe one deck.
I would play it in my Drownloo, which is basically Doomsday / Storm.
Well, there you go. That's a good place.
That's where
good
I play.
Place. Yeah.
But what I'm going to spend money on is get the red-white duo from Revised for Alesha.
Ah, Plateau.
Yeah, because I saw it, that's like 30-ish euros for a heavily played one, and that's not that much, so...
Well, that doesn't sound very bad for a revised duel. That's pretty good.
Yeah, because who plays Bateau anywhere?
I think a little bit in Legacy, right? Maybe, but I not in Vintage.
Legacy, I'm not sure that it's even there's anything that wants white and red together.
Okay, fair enough. I'm not a Legacy expert myself.
Me neither, but I'm thinking back, so...
It's a shame that you used the particular example of Plateau. What would the revised version having what I would call the incorrect art?
Let me compare.
The Alpha Beta Unlimited Plateau has art by Drew Tucker, and Wizards lost that art. They lost the original and the digital, so they couldn't reuse it again in revised. They had to commission a new art, which was done by Cornelius Broody, and they didn't correct the artist attribution in the revised version. So the revised art still says it's done by Drew Tucker, but it was not. It's Cornelius Broody.
Oh, yeah.
Art.
Yeah, the original is definitely nicer.
I'm a huge Drew Tucker fan, and I have affinity for the original version. Unfortunately, even in the unlimited form, as compared to revised, the price is twice as much, so it's sad.
But the art isn't that bad, and I like the writer on the top, I guess.
It is perfectly fine art. I enjoy it, actually.
But
it's just sadly not Drew Tucker's original.
Oh, well.
And you're right, the writer is kind of nice. It's an unusual touch in a land. In fact, that whole cycle, does that cycle depict a figure or character in any other land? I don't think it does.
I'm trying to think.
Oh, well, the Tundra has animals on it. Okay, so there's that. Tropical Island, which was originally the art for... the original art for Trop was Birds of Paradise. That had figures on it.
That's a fun story.
Yeah, I like that story. I'm trying to think, are there any animals on Savannah?
I really like the art for Thunder, though.
Yeah, big fan of that one. Most of those dual lands art is very, I guess I would say, understated.
Yeah.
Like the Scrublands, Badlands, Savannah are all very understated.
Badlands have nothing, if I remember correctly, in the art.
Same with Scrubland.
I should also get Badlands, because they're nice and cheap for Alicia.
Right.
And also Rob Alexander art.
Can't go wrong. Yeah, Scrubland has even less... Badlands at least has some, like, rocks for interest, but Scrublands...
Maybe rocks. We're not sure.
There's definitely rocks in the Badland art. There's definitely some standing stones there. It has some shadows. I would call it visually more interesting than Scrubland.
That's the point. You know what? Speaking of Rob Alexander, you know what makes me sad? I have a Blood Crypt in my deck, but it's sadly the Return to Ravnica one.
Oh, I gotcha.
So I'm missing on this sweet, sweet Rob Alexander art.
Yeah, I do really like that original Blood Crypt art. Most of the Ravnica lands are pretty sweet, honestly.
Oh, yeah. That art style is wonderful.
Yes, that whole cycle was pretty good.
And not just and the cycle, the basic lands as well.
Definitely. The new Ixalan Buddy lands...
Yeah,
are really good too, especially the Drowned Catacomb with all the ships on it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's incredibly awesome.
Also, Dragon's Call Summit is nice with the dragon slash dinosaur.
Yep.
What do you think about the Jace basic lands?
I think that's a cute gimmick. It doesn't really do anything for me myself, but I like tying the story elements into basic lands in that way.
I wouldn't mind if they started doing that more often. Just in those small mods.
Well, obviously they've been doing it from a setting standpoint for many, many sets, right? You just mentioned the Ravnica ones, for example. Those are depicting Ravnica in a healthy way. But the presence of a figure or a character in that setting, I think, is that this is a first for Magic in terms of basic land art and with a named character in it.
Yeah, personally.
Do you want him to see more of that?
Yeah, I wouldn't have minded to see, let's say, Sorin going through Tarkir. That would be nice.
I agree, and it would also do fun things for the flavor of people's decks. Imagine building a commander deck that had your commander walking through all the basic lands, for example, right?
Oh, that would be nice.
See, they're way behind on how many legends there are, but that would be really flavorful and fun.
Yeah, let's say in Lesha, with basics, I'm trying to depict, you know, let's say planes. All the, where would Alesha go as a, you know, horseman? All those types of lands. So I'm not going to put any Ravnica basic lands in here.
That makes sense. Sure.
Because she's not going to go to the city.
Right. She wouldn't be in the city. That's a good point. So you're stuck with that. So I can see why you're attracted to the rider in the plateau art. That's a good overlap there.
And a lot of basics I have, a lot of planes I have are the Christopher Rusher Arena ones. So
those are nice.
Huge open planes.
So do you normally, when you're building EDH decks, do you normally try and tie the basics into the deck in some way?
Yeah. Drahnul has only the old border lands. Not the beta ones, but, you know, something around Odyssey, that border.
Gotcha.
All the basics are in that style. They have to be. And all the cards I can get are in old border.
Right. Yes, I definitely prefer old bordered cards when I have a choice. I don't have any Eternal Masters things like Force of Wills or Sensei's Divining Tops, that kind of thing. But also, my affinity for lands goes back to Alpha and Beta.
Mm-hmm.
So when I can, which is most cases, the basic lands in my decks are Alpha Beta lands.
No, you can only be really pimp if you get only the mountains from Arabian Nights in your deck.
That's a good one. I own exactly one of those mountains, which I had just as a fluke because I thought it was funny. And also because I don't like red that much, I was never incentivized to get a whole bunch of mountains. I do, however, have a ton of islands from Alpha and Beta, which
because
was a good investment.
Because of course I do.
And also a huge stack of them are signed by Mark Poole, which is awesome. And you know, this year's Eternal Weekend is going to be awesome for that. Because, I mean, these are not new... What am I trying to say? It's not a new thing for these artists to be at Eternal Weekend. It's a very common thing. Mark Poole's been at there for a number of years. Chris Rush, rest in peace, had been there for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
But this year is an interesting thing because there are... I'm opening up the page to make sure I say the right thing here. Because Alpha Islands, unfortunately, Alpha Beta Islands were done by Mark Poole. He's not going to be there this year. He has been in years past. But the mountains were done by Doug Schuler, who will be there this year. The swamps were done by Dan Frazier, who will be there this year. And I forget, were the plains done by Mengus? I don't actually remember if Alpha Plains was Mengus or somebody else. Hold on.
Let me find.
I'm looking it up now. Alpha. No, it's Jesper. Sorry, it was Jesper Mirfors. So we've got 2 out of 5 of the Alpha Basic Land artists at Eternal Weekend this year, Dan Frazier and Doug Schuler. So I'm going to get a couple stacks of basics signed over the course of the weekend.
Where is the Eternal Weekend?
Well, the North American one is in Pittsburgh in 2 weeks.
And the European is going to be Paris or something like that, I guess.
Yes, I believe so, although I don't remember when. I can't off the top of my head.
It's too far for me anyway, so...
Do you know any of your friends have gone in the last couple of years?
Sadly, no. Although the Gas Cradle one would like to have gone, but work.
Yeah, understood. How long is that trip for you?
It's plenty of hours. The most profitable one would be to just sit on a plane and ride for like 2 hours, something like that.
Yeah.
But if you go by the land, it would be much, much farther.
Well, I can understand it's challenging to take a whole weekend to play Magic, no matter where you're going.
Plus, in my job line as a waiter, I really can't have the weekends off. So,
sure, weekends are your most busy times, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, yesterday was a fun day when I started working at 8, ended at 5, had like an hour or so off, and then came back to work until 11.
Yikes!
And then went to sleep. Went to sleep and started working from 8 again.
Good grief.
I should really be born as a millionaire son. That would be much, much more easier for me.
Right? Why didn't you do that?
I mean, honestly,
error on your part.
A misplay. If I could actually choose how to get, you know, huge stacks of money, I wouldn't have chosen to, you know, be a millionaire son. Honestly, because that's why I wouldn't appreciate the money.
Right, right.
This way, if you just gave me a huge stack of money, I would.
See, there you go.
So I wouldn't buy yachts or ships or something like that. No, I almost like to buy magic cards.
Magic cards are great. Still a good investment, too.
They're really good investment. If you can spend all the money.
Right.
Just buy all the dual lands and you'll be fine.
Exactly. And the didgeridoos.
Yeah, but not the Black Lotus. It's sad how Black Lotus isn't that good of an investment.
Not for the last several years, it hasn't appreciated very much, no.
Yeah, because you can get one, sure, but how are you going to sell it? To whom?
Yeah, it's definitely a low-volume market.
It's a nice thing to have, you know, as a thing you really like and appreciate.
Naturally, but
not a good investment.
I've had mine for a long time, so mine has appreciated, but I bought my Black Lotus in 1996.
Oof.
So that's a while back.
What's the condition of it?
Oh, it's played. I have played that Black Lotus without sleeves.
Oh.
So that should tell you something. It's not thrashed, but it's definitely heavily played.
The thing that hurt me was watching 99 Worlds, the coverage.
Right, they're and playing without sleeves.
Just mashing it. I'm like, could you not? I always want to watch that match, but I can't just because of that.
Yeah.
Every time they shuffle, I'm just like, no. This is cringe-inducing.
Boy, that takes me back. I played without sleeves for many years. It was awesome. And I played the now-defunct five-color format, which was always played without sleeves. And that was fun.
Not for the cards. Cards didn't have a good time.
That's true. I have a lot of guards that would complain about that time period, yes.
Also, where is Nyxia? What the hell?
So, are we still, like, on janky cards or stuff?
If you would like to answer that question, then go right ahead.
Would Nullbrosh be janky?
What?
I don't think so. That's borderline. Oh, yeah. It's really good in the decks that it's good in, so I would say that's not very janky.
Got any more?
Magetta the Lion.
Oh.
That's a pretty good one.
But that's not janky, though. That's actually useful.
What deck and what inspired you to play it?
Well, Karador, because I don't have any instant or sorcery, so I need some way to clear the board.
Oh, that's funny.
And nice. Magetta the Lion clears the board and gets cards in my graveyard, so it's a win-win.
That sounds like pretty good synergy, actually.
Yeah, that's the reason why I also run Nullbrosh, because I get rid of my hand, but that's not really a problem. And when I don't have a hand, it's pure value. Also, Thought Gorger.
No, Thought Gorger is so good.
But Thought Gorger isn't janky, he's actually like quite good in like, what's he called, the Gave.
Oh yeah, Gave.
Yeah.
I used to play him in Alesha. Maybe I should do that again. Although I have enough of card draw, I don't really need him.
Also, what else? I don't know, Mana Maze? I mean, who plays Mana Maze?
Now that's pretty janky.
You play Mana Maze, Nyxia. You play it.
I play Mana Maze because Mana
Maze... Why do you play Mana Maze?
Because I play Mana Maze in Reaper King, and when you cast Reaper King, nobody can cast a spell that turn, except you and your artifacts.
That's funny.
He actually... So, with Mana Maze, Reaper King can't be countered.
Right.
And also...
Do you also have Cavern of Souls on Scarecrow?
No, I don't have Cavern of Souls at all.
Okay.
But what's also very funny, actually, I haven't been able to do that yet, but I'm sure that it would be really annoying for a mono blue player if I play Mana Maze, and then it's his turn, and then I say, okay, your draw step, I cast Factor Fiction. Have fun playing cards.
That is super rude. You're right.
Have fun not playing Magic.
That is funny.
I was going to say a card, but then I remembered that it's not janky at all. Cyber Insanity. That's not jank.
No, that's pretty strong.
That's pretty good. It's the best when you play it for the first time. People are like, yeah, whatever. And then you're like, my end step, everybody discards their hands. Wait, what?
Uh-huh.
It's not my end? Oh, no, wait. What? control players.
I have a Gwendolyn deck that's focused on making everyone discard. And I have Sire and Nullbrosh in that deck.
Wasn't Sire Insanity played in Standard for like a brief second?
Yes, and it's still played in Legacy Reanimator as far as I know.
Oh yeah, because of course. It's a 6-4 beater that, you know, makes the control player not be control player anymore.
Right, right.
If they didn't force your reanimate, they're not going to do anything else this game.
Yeah, it's amazingly powerful. I don't accelerate it out quickly or reanimate it in my Gwendolyn deck. I just play it in earnest on turn 6 or so, and it's still pretty amazing.
I can sometimes reanimate it if I have, you know, Karma Guide or some shenanigans like that, but mostly it goes down on turn 5-6.
Right.
Which is good enough, because that's what I need, you know, mid-game to be, you know, cleared out, and then start winning the game with the value. Actually, a bit of a janky card is the Hope of Gitapur in EDH.
Oh, our review card.
Yep. I'm loving it because it's a one mana dude that, you know, pings dudes a bit, and then I decide that the blue player is not going to have fun next turn. And I attack with Alesha. And again. And again.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's great.
It's also pretty cool in Shirei.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, yep. I have a copy in Edric also.
It makes sense. It's a one mana flyer that has an upside.
Yeah.
Well, I also tried them once as a commander.
That's awesome.
Turns out that when people don't play removal and you play a Voltron build of Hope of Gheerapur, he ends games.
I can imagine. Because I briefly considered that. It's great.
It's a one mana, 1/1 flyer. Nobody's going to kill it because it's a one mana, 1/1 flyer. Who cares? And then suddenly you equip, I don't know, swords, you equip some other equipment, like a Loxodon Warhammer, and suddenly he hits you. And little by little, that commander damage.
Yep, that's pretty awesome.
He's a really cool card. I'm not sure
That would definitely be fun to watch.
I'm not sure if that's jank or not, that card, but it's really fun to play.
It's borderline, right? The example, Alesha's recursion, for example, right? That's not janky, that's just functional.
That's breaking the parity.
Exactly. And similar with Edric, right? Any 1/1 flyer in Edric is overperforms.
Yeah. And a 1/1 flyer that with an upside? Oh boy.
I was so happy when in Amonkhet they printed the snake, Slithering Stalker? Slitherblade, that's what it is.
Slitherblade, yeah.
Just 1 mana, 1/2 unblockable. So effective and efficient in Edric. That's the deck I rarely play.
It's also almost a ninja.
You know what
might
card?
Well do, right?
You know
it's
what
holding
card
two daggers.
You know what card almost made me real happy? The Rune Raider from the new set. The Rune Raider, the Bob that triggers in raid.
Right.
But it has 3 power. I'm still playing it, Alesha, but it has 3 power.
If it had two.
Basically, this podcast has a theory that perfect creature needs to be a 2/2. Because Alesha can reanimate it, and Recruiter of the Guard can fetch it. That makes it the perfect creature.
I mean, sure. I'll buy that.
That's how we go about things. Yeah. Of course, most creatures end up real bad, but you know.
And Hostage Taker just is so close.
Oh, jeez. I forgot when you mentioned Ixalan earlier completely about Hostage Taker, because it's such a good value card, but I didn't immediately want to put it in any of my decks.
It turns out it's a standard star.
I think in the long term it's going to be really good.
It already is.
It's just, it's just sickening the things you can do with it, right? I'm going to be so upset the first time someone takes, like, my Crucible of Worlds.
Of course, it would be much more fun if, you know, they enabled you to do the shenanigans that it says on the card.
Well,
because they have to rot it a bit.
For those of us who like games to end in rules-based draws, yes, I guess.
Yeah, Niksha?
What are you talking about?
I thought you were talking about adding colors to your deck.
Does he need to? Because Matas is doing the work, whatever his name is, real good.
Well, you can't. Yeah, but you can't play Hostage Taker in that deck.
Sacrifices need to be made. I just clicked on a random button on Gatherer and I saw the most sad card ever. Halo Hunter, do you remember that?
Yes, I do. That art is kind of grim, isn't it?
Yeah, but do you remember what was the purpose that it was supposed to be doing, but it didn't do in standard?
The angel.
Yeah, Baneslayer angel.
Baneslayer, that's the one.
Basically, you have only one job in this world, and you can't actually fulfill it.
Yeah.
Because when Halo Hunter comes into play, it destroys Target Angel, which is nice. But yeah. The Enslaved Angel, which was the big thing in Standard, had protection for demons. So, you know.
Yeah.
Poor man.
Do you play Baneslayer Angel in any decks?
I don't have one, but if I did, maybe I would.
It's a good card, though.
It's still a good card.
It's really still really efficient and effective.
And the protection is sometimes relevant.
Yeah, like Prof. Right.
Yeah.
There you go. That's funny. Or Karthus.
Yeah. Karthus is sad whenever a clone enters the battlefield.
Very much
oh,
so.
Oh no, now I lose. Damn it. I've seen that happen a couple of times, and it was always just like... But then again, what else do you play as your Dragon General? Prosh, which actually is a better choice, but...
But not really a Dragon's deck at that point.
The problem with Prosh is he does everything better than any other John Commander.
Exactly.
Sacrifice, Prosh is here. Dragons, Prosh can still be good, but you're still playing, also having Prosh in your command zone.
Right.
Yeah, like... One of the closest ones that I saw that was really good is the Cold Snap one.
Oh, yeah, but he's not that good. Sekor, the Deathkeeper.
Yep, he is. He can be.
Oh, he can be really good. Him. But the problem is he says non-token, and that's gimping you already.
That's keeping him in check. That's the only thing keeping him in check. But because Prosh he can trigger doesn't... off of himself. That's just not fair.
Only thing that Prosh has that's keeping him in check is to sacrifice another creature.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Jund has the problem where why would you play anything else? Maybe if you pick some of the partners, then you have some kind of a criteria. But they're not really Jund. They're two, three colors mashed up together. But actual Jund commander, Prosh is sadly the best.
Well... So we all talked about our jank cards and pretty much a lot of other things except jank cards.
I think since we've been talking for like 3 hours already, I think we had a good time having you here, Kevin.
I tend to have that effect on podcasts. I must apologize.
That's not a problem for us. More content is always better.
Well, so, I'm grateful that you asked me to be here. Thank you.
Anytime, since we apparently have had a real much fun with you.
Right.
But Kevin, where can our listeners find you?
Well, our show, So Many Insane Plays, okay, can be found on MTGCast or on Eternal Central. We maintain separate feeds there, so if you want to subscribe, you can do it in either or both. And we're going to be recording a Eternal Weekend prep show here inside of the next week. If you're the sort of person who's preparing for Eternal Weekend, for Vintage at least, we'll have a show out for you talking about the state of the metagame and what could be expected going into that event, and it'll come out shortly before Eternal Weekend Champs. And otherwise, we record about monthly, maybe a little bit less occasionally than monthly in some cases. But given that we're right around the Vintage Champs time, we will have a lot of material before and after to discuss. So now's a good time to tune in. If you just want to learn about Vintage, if you are preparing for Champs, if you just like to hear people analyze new Magic cards, we love our set reviews, that kind of thing. So take a look on MTGCast or Eternal Central for So Many Insane Plays.
And, of course, you can currently sometimes see Kevin battle Vintage out in VSL.
Oh, Vintage, yeah, it's so novel. I didn't even think to say it. Yes, I've been fortunate enough to be invited to this season of the Vintage Super League, which takes place on Tuesday nights live on Twitch. That's the Magic channel on Twitch, which hosts that. And then Randy Bueller publishes the videos the next morning on YouTube. So Vintage Super League, if you want to see me play against my podcast co-host Steve Menendian and other pros and Vintage players. I don't play every week because we have a rotating cast, so I'm every third week approximately. The next time I'll be on Vintage Super League will be on the 17th, I think it is.
Yeah.
Yes, a couple of Tuesdays from now, October 17th, I'll be playing that evening as well. That kicks off in the evening Pacific time, so it starts at Eastern time, it starts at 7:45.
For us Europeans, it starts in too early.
Yeah, sorry about that.
But see, because of my work schedule and me being insomniac, I can usually, when I wake up, catch you in the middle of the stream. So that's nice.
Funny. Well, and I understand for the European audience it's inconvenient, but the videos go up within about 12 hours. So you can still watch the YouTube replay, and that's all the content there too. So yes, thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, and this season the cast is stacked with people, really, really good Vintage players.
Yeah, it's a great cross-section of the Vintage and Pro Magic community, and yeah, I like all the people that are in there. It creates some interesting combinations, and for those who might not know, this particular season is what's called the Brewers Challenge, which means Randy has asked us not to play the same deck week over week. We are incentivized to play different things and to brew new things. And I have a somewhat unusual deck that I'll be playing on the 17th. It's not a mainstay of the format or anything. It's a little bit of a variation. So for those of you who are interested in watching different or variations on Vintage technology, this season favors that.
Now I have some ideas in my head what that might be.
Well, I mean, it's not going to blow the doors off of anyone, but it is a little bit unusual.
I mean, there's a couple of decks that are always on the fringe of the playability, but not on the mainstays.
Yep, it's true. Mm. I've got a variation on one of those at this point. So Brewer's Challenge means there will be some cool and unusual stuff happening in Vintage Super League for the next couple of months.
And we have already seen the Sorcerer's Spyglass being played, so that's good.
That's right. Ixalan's already had its impact.
And crushing people. Poor Randy.
Right, poor Randy indeed.
Okay, anything else we need to say, Niksha?
I think that about covers it.
Okay, you can find all of our information in the show notes, the card spheres, the tapped outs, all the decks. This has been episode 51, wasn't it, Niksha?
I'm pretty sure it's not episode 50.
Oh, I'm pretty sure it's not as well. And if you still want the competition for the Nixon's Altars is still open, so comment on our social media things.
Still open because Nixon is lazy.
Yeah. Pretty and much. As always, the Emperor protects.
He does indeed.